jazz.
Busted.
Okay.
Much better. I realized I should just keep this here by my desk.
Yeah, if your throat gets sore or your chair squeaky, either one. Exactly. Just escort a WD-40.
I noticed it yesterday because I had to record a lecture, re-record a lecture last night for my Friday lectures. And yeah, I was like, "What? Why is that so squeaky?" And I was like, "Oh, I got to fix that or Patrick will have a conniption." And then I forgot all day. So anyway.
That's right. I'm very demanding.
Fixed now. Ready
all
to
right.
go.
Well, we're adequately lubricated.
Oh, for fuck's sake, yes.
To start Jazz Bastard in my chair to squeak. I better get some WD-42. Hey, I never said it didn't, you know. Yeah, this is Jazz Bastard.
I'm not feisty and crabby about squeakage, so.
Yeah. Just try editing this son of a bitch once. I'll tell you.
What do you do with the dog? Are you ever? Can you handle the dog? Or is the
well,
dog?
The thing is, he mainly barks when you're talking, so the dog's just in there. I mean, I can't, you know.
I don't know if it's a he or a she, but yeah, I do feel like it's a longtime member of the podcast.
Absolutely. So. Very articulate in his or her opinions. What a bitch. Yeah, welcome to Jazz Bastard Podcast 180. You know, we've always been proud on this podcast that we have the skills to play the bills, and that's what we're doing today. I'm Pat.
I'm Mike.
And at Mike's suggestion, we're doing an all-Bill podcast. In fact, half of the podcast is devoted to white men named Bill Evans who play with Miles Davis.
And I'm sorry about that. I realized as we, you know, this is really a tale of two podcasts because, you know, as I was prepping and listening to this, it's like, one half of this podcast is squarely in the pocket and comfortable and easy peasy lemon squeezy. And the other half makes my brain hurt.
Yeah. Yeah. It's inside and outside. Oh, my. Talk about the albums you picked for this one.
Right. So recent acquisitions, I got a hold of Bill Evans, the pianist, what's often regarded, certainly the Penguins regarded as the last hurrah, a very late album called You Must Believe in Spring with Eddie Gomez on bass. That's the main thing. And then Elliot Zygmunt on drums. And it's one of the last studio dates that he did before his demise. And then the other disc is by Bill Evans, the white saxophonist, Starfish and the Moon. And he is a former sideman with Miles, and you can say more about that in a while, but he plays soprano and I guess tenor on that album. So those are the two that came into my possession recently, and I thought, let's do four Bills. So
right. I picked Bill Dixon, the trumpet player's Intents and Purposes from 1967 on RCA. I'd picked that up on vinyl. And I think you picked Bill McHenry's album Roses on Sunnyside.
Yes.
From 2008.
I did.
And You Must Believe in Spring was recorded in 1977, but released in 1980 after Bill passed, Bill Evans, the piano player, and then Starfish and the Moon was an escapade from 1997. So those are the selections. Are we going to go chronologically, or do you want to do like soft and easy and mean and squeaky, or what do you want to do?
Your call. I don't care. I'm ready for whatever.
Well, let's do inside then go outside. Because I just can't imagine trying to, you know, go from Bill Dixon Intents and Purposes to Bill Evans You Must Believe in Spring. That's just like, I don't think the transition is possible in my mind. So maybe start with Bill Evans, You Must Believe in Spring. I think Wikipedia said this was his 70th studio album. It's like, holy
wow. Shit.
But
that's not as a leader. That's
No, I believe as a leader. Yeah.
Really? He made that many as a leader?
Let me check here. But I don't want to like, you know, be too definitive about this. But
that's positively John Zorn-esque.
Right.
That's David Murray-esque.
The only possible relationship between Bill Evans and John Zorn is they made a lot of records.
Right.
Yep, that's what, well, it just says Wikipedia, our source of all information, is a 70th studio album by American jazz pianist Bill Evans. Now, that to me implies with him as a leader as opposed to him appearing, but I don't know. He recorded a fuck ton.
He did.
And this is where he goes from his longtime home Fantasy to Warner Brothers. And apparently they were not that impressed with the product, even though it just sounds fantastic, because they would not release it.
Right.
Until he died. You know, he's got a song to his brother Harry on this album, and Harry doesn't shoot himself in the head for another couple of years, but my God, what a, you know, I was looking up Bill Evans' life, and it's 73 that his common-law wife or girlfriend, read somewhere, I had not realized this before, he apparently wanted a child very much, and that was just not possible with her, but she threw herself in front of a subway train. And then his much-beloved brother Harry, who suffered with depression and mental illness, shot himself. And then that was kind of the last straw. This was in 79. And so what someone described as the longest suicide in history concluded in 80 as he died, Bill Evans. So this, you know, I don't listen to this thinking this is a guy on his last legs, but it's certainly a Twilight effort. What does it stand for you on the canon, which, of course, as we've just mentioned, is immense?
So I'm struck by a couple of things. I mean, we talked about an earlier, was it the Live at the Gate or whatever?
And, right.
And that's with Eddie Gomez also on bass. And
but brand new, his very first, where this is like his very last, yeah.
Very last. And we had talked about how Eddie Gomez brings a little fire, brings a little fiber, and that seems to be something useful for Evans. You know, Evans on the trio dates, most famously the Scott LaFaro, Paul Motion trio. Is that right? Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
That was kind of a watershed. And then LaFaro tragically died, incredibly young, and Evans kind of went into the shitter for a little while. Another tragedy in the life of Bill Evans. So anyway, you know, Eddie Gomez feels like, we talked about this before, it feels like a co-creator, like a partner of relatively equal stature who seems to call out a little more fire from Evans. That isn't as much the case here, and it's not that Gomez's playing isn't as wonderful. I think on We Will Meet Again for Harry. It almost sounds like a guitar at some points, the speed with which he's playing. But everything here is kind of, you know, balladesque and, you know, Bill Evans, lugubrious, bleeding over the keys, at his best, sort of hard on his sleeve mode here. And it's not as, it doesn't have as much tension as that earlier date that we talked about. This feels very comfortable, very loungy almost. You could imagine, you know, this at a really cool nightclub, everyone wearing cool jewelry and leisure suits and drinking fancy mixed drinks and just kind of, you know, slowly getting stoned while Bill does his thing. It has that kind of feel to it. Yeah, I mean, I like it. I don't think it's head and shoulders above everything else. And I don't think if he hadn't have died a couple of years later, it would be as well regarded as it is. It is a little too on the nose that the last cut here is the theme song from MASH.
Yeah.
Suicide is painless. I know.
Unfortunate choice there, yeah.
Yeah, but everything Bill Evans does, there's very little bad Bill Evans. And this just feels like a man very much in tune with his muse, and he's got a sympathetic accompaniment. But in this case, it doesn't feel like there's as much tension. He's not being pushed as hard. So it's a very fine date, a very enjoyable date. But I don't, you know, I think the Penguins give it 4 stars or something. That feels like a star too much.
Mm, yeah.
It's good, but it's not, you know, towering. You know, this isn't Waltz for Debbie, or it's not that good. I mean, it's good, but it's
right.
Nothing that we haven't heard many, many times from Bill Evans before. And maybe we're just spoilt because, you know, he's just so consistently good that playing like this would be, you know, something that probably many pianists would give their eye teeth for, you know. And from Bill Evans, maybe it feels a little bit less. I don't know. I mean, I'm kind of curious what a pianist slash reviewer like Ethan Iverson would make of it.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
Where he would sort of fall on the spectrum of, you know, late Bill Evans. But as far as like enjoyable, I mean, my God, it's just, you just put this on, you know, pour yourself a glass of wine, sit back and just bathe in the wonderfulness that is Bill. It's very, very enjoyable. It's super accessible.
Take a Bill bath. There you go.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, this is like entry level. Like, if you don't know anything about jazz, you could turn this on and go, yeah, I'm into jazz. You know, I mean, it's very,
there you go.
Very user friendly. It's not demanding. It's very pleasant. And I imagine for someone who's really musically knowledgeable, it is really rewarding, you know, if you really know what Bill's up to. But for just the average listener, this is easy to get into and very pleasant, I think. So yeah, I like it quite a bit. But yeah, I don't think it's, you know, Titanic Bill Evans by any stretch. I think it gets a bump because of the circumstances surrounding it more than anything else.
Yeah,
how do you feel about it?
Yeah, I think you could argue that it, and we've talked, it's weird, we've talked about Bill several times, we also refer to him, but in terms of talking about his albums directly, we talked about Live at Art de Lugoff's Top of the Gate back in episode 8.
Right.
So it was a Resonance Records, one of their early sets. We talked about his duet album with Jim Hall, Undercurrent, on episode 34, and we talk about one of his worst all-time albums, Plays a Theme from VIPs and Others, on episode 144, when we talked about odd, in some cases bad or strange projects by major jazz musicians on that strange episode 144. But we've never talked about Waltz for Debbie. What's the matching one with that? Live at the Village Vanguard, whatever the name of that is. Sunday at the Village Vanguard.
And that's all set. I mean, you can get the complete of
those sessions. Those are both from the same couple of nights. And I mean, the short answer for someone brand new to Bill Evans looking for the heart of the repertoire, I'd always say is just the Riverside albums.
Yes, just get any Riverside in your set.
Right, I mean, there's a live one that's Shelly Man's Hole that I've never found that much interest in. His very first album are kind of miniatures. He's not fully formed, but everything else on that label is pretty awesome. But he does extensive work for Verve. I finally tracked down, I won't say how, a rip of his complete Verve recordings. He records extensively for Fantasy. And, you know, some for Warner Brothers and, you know, a couple for MPS. They released a couple sessions of his, I think, on Resonance that was recorded in Germany. So, I mean, you know, but the main strain of it. And there's a whole bootleg series of live recordings taped off someone's, you know, hidden tape recorder. And there's a couple boxes of his final live stuff when Mark Johnson was in the group. After, because this is the album that after this, Eddie Gomez checks out. This is his last performance. Some people claim, you know, he's especially giving and on point for this record. You know, he's certainly mixed. You know, Eddie is a co-equal partner in the sound field, right?
Yes.
You know, you can hear him. I think the record hangs together. It's relatively short, and it's a record that works as a record. It does establish a mood, maybe a little too closely in that it doesn't veer a lot. It sounds gorgeous. It's just a good audio document. But of course, the Riverside sound are gorgeous. So you can get that, maybe a little different sound, but pretty fantastic sound on those sessions too from the 50s. Yeah, I liked it. I think at this stage, Bill is, it'd be harsh to say he's embroidering, but he is playing pretty.
Yep.
Just a lot of pretty cascading patterns. Some of the tension of the rhythmic drive that you hear in his best stuff. And we've mentioned, you know, he's on the Jazz Workshop session with George Russell. That's just a towering small group recording. And he's one of the reasons that's so fantastic. You know, he's more in a Lenny Tristano mold as a young man. He could be a lot more driving and linear. And here he's after kind of beauty, and he's not so much into tension. It's more these figures that are just, they're gorgeous. But, you know, if you listen, if you get anywhere close to his whole body of work, which is just enormous, yeah, you're going to start to hear gestures. You're going to start to hear pet licks, especially in the later years. That's like, oh, there he goes again. That is still gorgeous. That's a pretty thing. Not every piano player could play it, but it's not like white hot invention. It's kind of more, yeah, this is not loungy. You know, that's too strong. But pleasant, as you said. So yeah, I liked it. you know, I think, as you said, as an entry point, in some ways, it might be more accessible than the Live Village Vanguard stuff, where, you know, LeFaro is kind of challenging you, and in some ways a less digestible bassist and probably a less complete bassist than Eddie Gomez, who's just, you know, one of the great monsters. The drummer, as usual, is very discreet. Yeah, it's nice to hear him playing a couple tunes that are more of recent vintage, but Evans has always been a guy that was content with a very small, relatively speaking, repertoire, you know, certainly compared to the number of records he recorded. You know, he'd go back to favorites rather than, you know, try the latest thing constantly. You know, there's a lot of live recordings of MASH, is what I'm trying to say. If you want to hear the theme from MASH, there's probably like a dozen versions of his that he does. And in this one, I feel like it's almost purely broidered statements of just very pretty melodic patterns. You don't feel like he himself is producing a lot of melodic, or I don't know. It's a long way from Brad Mehldau, right? He's not dissecting things.
He's not a ruthless. At no point in his career is he really kind of a ruthless eviscerator of tunes.
So that's why I think in some ways Mehldau always resented. It's like, I'm white, I'm gloomy, but damn it, I'm not Bill Evans. And I think he's absolutely right. You know, if you listen to him for any length of time, you're not going to mistake them. There aren't that many similarities between the two of them. And I love them both. But yeah, it's a fine record. I would certainly not turn it down if I saw it in a bin or as an LP. You know, it's a fine Late Testament version. And I will say it doesn't, some of his stuff, the live stuff towards the very end, there's a sense of kind of pushing, a sense of edginess isn't quite right, but straining for effect. And that's not the case here. Everything is controlled in that sense, and you don't feel like he's trying and failing to kind of produce an effect. He's just doing it. But yeah, I you know, for God's sakes, go to the Riverside's first. And there are gems after that. But you know, one would be Undercurrent with Jim Hall, as long as you don't read the liners, which are just fucking acid. But they make no sense. So the next album, if you're ready to move on, is by this guy, Bill Evans, the second white Bill Evans.
Right, the other white Bill Evans.
Right, the one that he has had a steady recording career since working with Miles Davis in the 80s. You know, I was looking around. He's tried different contexts. Some are more acoustic, some are more electric. I was on Spotify 30 minutes ago and dialing stuff up, and there's, you know, something with kind of almost a bluesy edge with a bit of a vocalist going on. He's been a working musician since then, but in some ways he's one of the guys associated with Miles who probably got the less mileage, as it were, out of the association, the least boost to his rep. He appears on The Man with a Horn, which is in the running for one of Miles' worst albums. That was the comeback when he was still getting the big lumps of cocaine out of his system. He's on We Want Miles, which I don't know what you think about that live double album, but I always liked it. But it's mainly Marcus Miller's album, and in fact, a lot of Bill's solo statements were cut out of that. He's on Star People, which was probably the bluesiest and jazziest of the comeback albums on Columbia, and on Decoy. But on Decoy, Branford Marsalis appears on a track or two, and that's what everybody remembers. So, to be honest, I didn't even know Bill Evans was on Decoy, you know. So, these were not, they were in a sense reputation making in that just he worked for Miles Davis. You know, I mean, it, for God's sakes, you know, that's a pretty scarce credential. Not too many people can flash it, especially now. But his appearances there did not make him a favorite among the jazz aficionados, right? It was known. I don't think he was hated. Some people really just hated Mike Stern, the rock guitar, who was very playing rock licks, you know, playing distorted guitar, sounding nothing like Jim Hall. And some people just found it annoying showboating. But I don't feel like Evans made a big noise playing with Miles. And he was soon replaced by, like, Kenny Garrett, who, in terms of, I think, mainstream jazz credentials, you know, has done better long term. So you pick this one up. Do you have other Bill Evans? Do you?
This is my first one.
Okay. And just because you'd heard of him. And so what do you think of Starfish and Hutch? Starsky and Starfish and Hutch. No, what is it called? What's the...
Starfish and the Moon.
Okay, I'm going to go with my title. It's better. I'm just saying. Yeah, Starfish and the Moon. This is apparently at the time was considered an acoustic effort by Bill.
Right.
And one of the great mysteries, why didn't he fucking change his name? I mean, I don't...
Why not William? Why not William? Why not Billy?
Props to the guy. I again, in a way, I respect it, but it's like, you're a bland-looking white guy, and you're following in a group where the you know, a really famous musician named Bill Evans came. I don't know. What's your middle name, dude? Sexy Mystery Boy? I don't know. Name yourself Starfish. Starfish Evans. Anyway. Frank Zappa would have great ideas for you, dude. But yeah, it's led to the greatest brand confusion in the history of jazz. Which Bill Evans do you mean?
Yeah, because he refuses, you know, he never, you know, swapped out the name or anything.
In a way, propers to him. But another way, what the fuck were you thinking, dude? Anyway.
So I was going to say, I think it's kind of interesting that late Miles in the I guess, late 70s or, you know, early or whatever, late 70s, 80s, Miles kind of functions as the second version of Art Blakey's messengers, right? Because the number of people who pass through his orbit and then get a little rocket boost from that,
right,
is significant. There's a significant number of them. And probably, you know, based on just the lack of sheer recognition, maybe Bill Evans is one of the few who got the least bump out of that. You know?
So I'd argue they're reversed in that Blakey brought people into the fold to play Blakey-style music,
right,
whereas Miles always brought young people in the fold to kind of goose what he was doing and move it forward. You know, he was looking for someone to bring in, you know, whether it's Wayne Shorter or John Coltrane or whoever, something new to the mix that he was then going to, like, use his aesthetic genius to kind of make coherent and produce something with. So but yeah.
Yeah, so Miles is kind of finishing school for a lot of guys, and I don't know much about the career of this Bill Evans, but on the strength of this album, I mean, we're close to smooth jazz. This is where fusion kind of turns into smooth jazz, isn't it?
Real close, dude.
it has some acoustic edges, so it's, and I think some of the it has some almost, I don't almost want to say Americana edges with the use of acoustic guitars that I think, and mandolin that appear here, that kind of keep it from pitching over fully into Kenny G territory. That's very harsh, because even if you don't like the production with the voices in the background here, this never gets as far into Bluebird land as, you know, Kenny G is. Mostly he plays soprano on this album, and it's a very pretty album, very enjoyable, and it's very easy to turn into background music. There's only a couple of cuts here that kind of have enough fiber that force me to pay more attention to them. The gritty Whiskey Talk, which is a kind of funk blues number where he takes up the tenor on that album, on that song, and I think it's all the better for it. That has a kind of funk feel, some nice electric organ on that one. And it's only a couple of times. And for the most part, this is, you know, sweet, sweet soprano saxophone, easy listening on the FM dial. and I, you know, I like it, but it's not very demanding. It doesn't ask a lot of the listener. Like the other Bill Evans, it's pretty in the pocket and pretty enjoyable, but it's also not terribly demanding, and as a result, it's often not very memorable. I will admit that the one song I remember here is Whiskey Talk. All the rest...
Is that the one that's playing now? Because it's pretty audible. Is that...
Oh, sorry. No. That's Shady Lady, which is okay.
Shady like Lady. Rhymes.
Whiskey Talk is the one that sounds like... I can't think of the... What's that one song? You know that you love me, baby.
Fever? No.
Something. No.
Okay.
Some,
kind of funky.
Some like, you know, Cream song or something.
Okay.
You know, it's got that kind of lick.
Yeah, okay.
Anyway, that's maybe why it sticks with me. So anyway, I enjoy the album. I think it's fine. I guess I want to hear him do something a little more with a little more fiber in it. I'd like to hear something that's a little more pressing, a little more tension laden than this is. This is very pleasant, but it's also kind of easy and as a result, not terribly memorable. You know, if you look at his discography, I mean, it's kind of a who's who and a what's what of players of that ilk, right? So you find a lot of Brecker brothers, you'll find Wallace Roney, Lee Ritenour, people like that appear on his albums. Hornsby, for God's sakes.
I guess on this one in particular, do we have personnel?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So I'm sorry. Jim Beard and Henry Hay, whomever they are, play keyboards. We have two different guys playing guitars, Adam Rogers and John Harrington. And Adam Rogers is responsible for the mandolin playing here as well. So sometimes we have some mandolin bits. That's Adam Rogers. And then James Genus is the bass player. Vinnie Colaiuta is the drummer. And then there is a gentleman with pretty unpronounceable Armenian name playing percussion. That would be Arto Tungboyasyan something. And then a couple of people doing sort of the vocal, you know, ooh, ah, wah, wah, wah sounds in the background.
Did you notice that one of them was a Leonhardt child?
I did. It's Donna Leonhardt and Jay Leonhardt's daughter. Yes.
Yeah, that's awesome. Good for her. She got a good meal out of that or two. That to me was the hardest bit, the bit that kind of drove me away from the record, in that it just seemed to kind of somehow transition it across the border to easy listening light jazz land, and that was the vocals. It just seemed like one step too many in the production of this record, because it's very smooth and easy flowing. Don't necessarily have a problem with that. You know, I'm spending a lot of time, especially recently, I'm at my desk furiously drafting stuff, so I don't want something super demanding. So, you know, I'm up for easier to digest music, but it's just those vocals, just a step too far, Bill.
It's not words, it's just wow.
It's like, is this some kind of ethnic soap dispensary place where I get my bubble? It's just too much. And you know, he's a fine, solid player in that idiom. And every now and then, I think I was listening to another record, it's like, oh man, yeah, I remember that lick from the Miles albums. And that was kind of, that brings back happy memories. But
right.
Because I do like, there are moments on Man with a Horn that are not as embarrassing as the title track. And I've always liked We Want Miles, and Decoy's a favorite album of mine, but not particularly for Bill Evans' contributions. So, you know, it's an era of Miles that was my era into the guy. I mean, those were the records that were out and circulating as a kid who was getting into jazz at that time. They were in the, you know, in the mall record store. So that's kind of my entry to them. But yeah, I don't know that on the basis of this. Now, this was unusually acoustic and chill for him. I guess he was mainly known as a fusion shredder.
Yeah, yeah.
A guy whose contacts were more like those in We Want Miles, with maybe a fairly aggressive guitar player. And so I have not heard those. I just, there was, and again, I'm not trying to diss the guy or whatever, but I just never had a particular urge to track him down as a leader, having heard his contributions on Miles's albums. I wasn't offended by them or disliked them, but it just wasn't compelling enough for me to find them. And I don't think, you know, at that time, the jazz press was particularly kind to him. So I was not getting signals that this is somebody you have to search out, fairly or not. You know, I don't, you know, there's always that when you're in the spotlight like he was, it's a very different story than if the same guy had walked through and just started releasing records, identical records, if you never play with Miles. So that makes sense. Now, he may not have been allowed to if you never, you know, but the critics are kind of expecting something. You both get the bump and the honor of having done it, but then these expectations are larger than they might be for somebody without that credential. But my memory is, you know, they weren't that well loved. And I'm still, you know, there's like one he did on Blue Note, the Something Man, that I feel like I remember hearing about as a kid. Maybe I should stream it someday. You know, again, I don't know. And depending on your mileage, listeners, if you're very much to the right and you like extremely consonant and kind of soothing music, that's what you're looking for. One, why would you ever listen to us? Because we're just a pain in the ear anyway. But if you know, if that's what you're looking for, it's here, but I'd look for something without those damn horribleous vocals. I just, eh. But if we're through with him, let's talk about a real sellout, a real peddler of elevator music.
Oh, yeah.
Bill Decks and God. What?
What the fuck?
Man, I just, Jesus Christ, Bill. Why don't you just get Mitch Miller? Okay, we joke. Bill is insane. He gives no fuck whatsoever about the audience.
He has no fucks left to give.
He is uncompromising. and I, of the two out projects, I like this one the best. I will, spoilers, Bill Dixon's Intents and Purposes. I mainly know him through a set of Soul Note Black Saint recordings that I got in a box. Bill is kind of a minimalist, breathy style avant-garde trumpet player. Not a blaster, for the most part. And I knew him from small groups, but this 1967 release features a couple larger groups along with a couple bookend pieces that are much shorter, where he's playing with a flautist and overdubbing himself on flugelhorn. So there are four tracks. Metamorphosis is kind of the best known piece, and that includes Bill on trumpet and flugelhorn, Jimmy Cheatham on bass trombone, Bayard Lancaster and Robin Kenyatta, and I know Kenyatta is a name I've heard before, on alto sax, George Marge on English horn, Catherine Norris on cello, Jimmy Garrison and Reggie Workman on bass, Robert Frank Pazer on drums, Mark Levin on percussion, and Bayard Lancaster. Am I saying that right? What is that? How do you say it?
That sounds right.
Bayard Lancaster on bass clarinet. So not only on alto sax, but on bass clarinet. And then for voices, which is about the same length, they're both in the 13-12 minute range, Bill's there with just Catherine Norris, Jimmy Garrison, Robert Frank Pazar, and Bayard Lancaster. So it's a smaller group, another extended piece, and then there's a Nightfall piece at the end of each side of the LP that runs three and a half minutes. And those are the kind of duets with overdubs of Bill again, and George Marge on flute. So just a very interestingly constructed record. This is not about one ensemble playing different pieces. It's about units where they're different ensembles. Obviously, a lot of this is really highly written out. It's pretty out, though I'd say the Nightfall pieces, I don't know, I think they're fairly digestible. They're not real stressful. And this is kind of his famous statement as a band leader, I guess. His career goes on for many years, and I think a lot of the stuff on Black Saint Soul Note is excellent. I really like it, but it is smaller in scale. What do you think of the jazz artistry of Bill Dixon, Intents and Purposes?
So I too like this, probably the best of anything we're talking about this week, and I'm not even 30% on the way to fully digesting what the hell is going on.
Amen, brother. Yeah, I'm right with you.
It's the Nightfall pieces are they're little amuse-bouches, they're palate cleansers, and they're not what you come to this album for. I mean, they're fine, but Metamorphosis is the one that kind of is the demanding, challenging piece, and it's just challenging and demanding. You know, I don't even kind of know how to characterize it. It kind of sounds a little bit like, you know, the ensemble begins with some assorted kind of chording is too strong of a word, you know, but sort of, you know,
notes played simultaneously.
Notes played simultaneously, dissonantly, with him kind of noodling is actually too busy a word, him you know, sort of playing trumpet over. And then it modulates. It's several minutes long, and so it has kind of different moments in it. Around minute three, it kind of the one of the bass players. I don't know who. I wanna guess Workman based on what I've heard of him, but I could be wrong. One of the bass players sort of takes up with a kind of melodic figure, and Dixon begins sort of soloing lightly and brightly over that. For me, the favorite part is kind of in the middle, right around minute four or so. George Marge comes in on that English horn, and my God, if there's one thing we don't have enough of in jazz, it's oboe and English horn. I really like the pairing there of Marge's horn with Bayard Lancaster's bass clarinet. That is some really cool playing there, and that means it's got to be Kenyatta playing alto sax. Three of them, three winds are playing together, and Kenyatta's alto sax at that moment. It's really kind of angsty and skittery over the horn and bass clarinet, and that's a sweet spot. That's a couple of 3 minutes of mm-hmm, oh yeah, really like that. The choice of bass trombone here, Jimmy Cheatham, I like quite a bit as well, because that's also part of it. Somewhere around the 6.5 minute mark or so, we get some bass trombone figures with the English horn and alto sax playing over, and I like that stuff a whole bunch as well. And then it's got like another shift right around minute eight or so, and we get this kind of thumping percussion, Prozar and Levin kind of get busy on the percussion. And again, we get sort of ensemble, I don't know, chords, something with Bill Dixon kind of playing trumpet over. And then we get some really busy alto sax kind of squalling on the rest of the way out. It doesn't have a melody as far as I can tell. It's kind of one thing leads into another thing, leads into another thing, with different kind of sonic moments of organized beauty. For me, the middle passages with the woodwinds are the strongest and the most interesting and are really kind of arresting. But yeah, that song, Metamorphosis, there's only two ways to listen to it. Either it's background and you're just not clued in, or you drop everything and you put on the big boy headphones and you just turn out the lights and just concentrate. There is no middle ground on this stuff at all. So, you know, like the Bill Evanses, you can let them be background, and if you focus on them, you're like, oh yeah, nice. And they go back to being background pretty easily. This, you're either all in or you're all out. You just kind of lock in on what he's doing here, or you give up and just let it be background, because there's no middle here. There's no way to kind of tune in or tune out of this. I don't know anything that sounds quite like this. You know, we like a lot of out players who do sparse things with, you know, weird, funky instrumentation. Henry Threadgill comes to mind, but this isn't like that. It's its own thing. And, you know, this is kind of broadly regarded as his masterpiece. And I take it, it's the two longer cuts that really are responsible for that. I like, Voices as well. Voices as well is pretty cool. It's got some bowed bass and stuff over it. That one's a little more meditative for the first 4 minutes or so, and then Bill starts getting busy around minute five or so, and then we get that sweet English horn again right around 5.5 minutes. Yeah, and the percussion here, which bangs in around minute nine or so, starts to sound like really heavy thudding. Jungle,
yeah,
or something, you know, and it's so
awesome, right?
Yeah, so resting given what we've heard before. So yeah, I mean, you know, I don't know what to make of this. I'm just kind of finding my way into it now, and I've now listened to the damn thing, let's see how many times, the whole thing at least 4 times, and some of the tracks, the Metamorphoses and Voices 6 or 7 times each, and I'm still just trying to find my way into it. It's just really demanding. It's definitely out, and it's definitely challenging. You know, if you want, if you need, in order for your ears to be pleased, consistent melody or consistent rhythmic groove, you are not going to like Bill Dixon. You're not going to like this album. But if you're willing to kind of be patient and sort of hunker down and listen to this and let it wash over you, it's not that long. It's about half an hour long.
Yeah, the whole album is about half an hour, yeah.
So it's worth the listening. It's worth the sitting down and trying to kind of just think your way into it. But it's not, it's a steep climb. It's not easy at all. But I did enjoy it. And, you know, I find that it rewards close attention. The more you listen to it, it's not like you suddenly instantly grok it or something, but it is, there are moments of luminous beauty within it that kind of reveal themselves if you attend carefully to what you're listening to. If you don't, it's perfectly fine, but I don't think it yields up its treasures unless you really bear down and think hard about it while you're listening. That's my experience with it so far. And like I said, I'm only part of the way there with this music. I'm going to have to listen to it several more times before I feel comfortable. And other Bill Dixon, you know, you've introduced me to a number of his other things, Vade Mecum and blah, blah, blah. I found them more accessible than this. This was far and away the most challenging thing by him I've heard yet, but simultaneously the most rewarding.
Yeah, you know, as a improviser in a small group context, he is out and he's challenging, but at the same time, I feel like he's relatively accessible. He's not about blasting.
No.
He's got a, I don't want to say a hummable melodic sense, but he is more in the lyrical tradition than the energy tradition. So yeah, I would agree that this is a different level of challenge. I was trying to think of any kind of, so if you want some English horn in mildly avant-garde writing, much more mainstream than this, you might look at Andrew Hill's Passing Ships,
with
Joe Farrell, who could just play every woodwind well, does that once or twice. And it, again, it's much more mainstream than this, but it not being a criticism of it, I quite like it. I'm more likely to listen to it. And then, you know, when we talked about Ingrid Laubrock's, what was the name of that? Random something, something, that large ensemble piece she did.
Contemporary Chaos Practices.
There you go.
Yeah.
That felt to me like an attempt that did not come off as well at a kind of a project out of this lineage.
Right, right.
And to me, it suffered a bit from gigantism. It was just too many musicians, and also just, I felt like that was a firmly, thoroughly unmistakably third stream project, where this, I feel like, includes third stream elements, but also some sense of some connection, however tenuous, to jazz. It's not a finger-snapping, hip-shaking jazz album, God knows, but it didn't seem quite so disconnected from the jazz tradition as hers did. And it's 30 minutes, you know, and there are...
When you say third stream, by the way, explain what you mean by that.
Well, just a sense, and really, to be honest, a more contemporary classical, but the tradition of mixing classical forms and jazz forms, which, again, in my pet theory that jazz is supposed to be liminal, at least for me, I like it best when it's the tension between art and popular music, and it explores that tension rather than committing itself firmly to one or the other. That tends to be examples of music that is committed firmly to the art side of the equation and often doesn't have any, you know, cyclical forms or any pop content. Whereas, you know, every tune that certainly Bill Evans' piano player plays is a tune, you know, he's improvising on it, but it's a form that's from a popular song, it's not based on Brahms or something.
Right.
So anyway, this there is that sense of high seriousness, of art music, of through-composed stuff, but for whatever reason, I feel like there is some element, too, of the jazz tradition and lyricism. And I quite like, I mean, the two Nightfall pieces aren't, I think they've got their value, and especially as you said, palate cleansers, you know, after 13 minutes of fairly challenging stuff, it's just kind of neat to listen to a couple musicians play fairly atonal, but yet pleasant and easily parsable music. Yeah, this one is just, I feel like, yeah, you could go back to it another 10, 20 times and still not feel like you've got the whole narrative or the whole meaning of that first track on Intents and Purposes, Metamorphosis. That just, wow. And to some degree, Voices. It's just a lot to unpack, but I agree it's rewarding. So this is just one I'd heard about. I think it came out on CD and then I ran across it on vinyl a few weeks back and thought, well, yeah, this is something I, in the very, very back of my mind, I knew was supposed to be pretty important landmark in avant-garde music and important in his discography, and it's worth picking up.
How is the vinyl sound compared to the CD?
I have not heard the CD. I think the vinyl is perfectly fine. The thing I sent you was a dub of it.
Right.
And it did not suffer from that dramatic compression of sound, that quiet, muffled sound that we had on the Contemporary Jazz Quintet release. I thought it was certainly quiet pressing. It was well done. I mean, RCA, the original, how the fuck Bill Dixon ever got on RCA? I just don't know. I don't know that much about that label. I tend to think of them as people that only dabbled in jazz, but were pretty smart about sound. Certainly some of the records there are very good sounding.
They're deep into the classical and right. They're deep into the dissonant classical tradition.
That's true.
Maybe that's the window here.
Yeah.
They're early champions of Bartok and things like that. So maybe that's the window here.
I think it's a series. You know, one thing I got this library sale was two or three or four Prokofiev records. I think it's all RCA, and they're pretty good.
Yeah.
Pretty good. You know, I kind of like his stuff, and, you know, they sound pretty fucking good. So, you know, in a way, the good news is here, I think that whatever you want to say, the product, just the raw tape, was better done to begin with this project as opposed to the Contemporary Jazz Quintet album we talked about two or three episodes back. It's just, they're just starting from a better place because RCA's pretty good. And then I think the pressing was a little better. But I mean, I'm not going to argue there's any reason not to get this on CD. Or I don't know. It may sound even better on CD, but this is how I happen to run across it. But yeah, strongly recommended. This is, of these four recordings, the clear masterpiece, as long as you're willing to go way left and out. I mean, if you hate out music, there's nothing wrong with that. You avoid it like the fucking plague. But if you're an adventuresome listener, to me, it, as challenging as it is, in some ways, it brought me more pleasure than I was afraid it might. I don't know what kind of endorsement that is, but, you know, thinking, this is like, okay, I got a couple of Joe Henderson records, and this is my medicine. This is because I'm a good boy. I'm going to get intents and purposes. I know it's good for me, but I don't know if I like it. And I liked it more than, as somebody who enjoys some avant-garde music, but it's not my bread and butter. There's a lot to enjoy here.
Cool.
Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off there. I was kind of
No, you're good. I was listening. I'm fine.
Okay.
What you had to say.
Yet another Bill. There are so many Bills. I mean, we probably could have done Bills for another three episodes. I can't think, you know, there's got to be a lot of other Bills, right?
Bill McNeil, who else? Blah, blah, blah.
There are other Bills. Let's take our word for it. We can't think of them right now because it's late, especially for me. And
there's got to be a Bill Smith.
Oh, there is. There's a Bill Smith clarinetist, and he does this album called Folk Jazz that is I kind of like. And I can't defend that much, but I do kind of like it. And he plays with Brubeck a while, but I don't know that I like that phase. He's, you know, folk jazz, fun little record.
Bill Monk and Bill Biderback and Bill Davis. And there's a Bill Davis. And
We've talked about Bix Biderback somewhere. I feel like.
I'm being obnoxious. Yes, we have.
But anyway, I was thinking.
We could do him again.
Bix is coolest name in jazz.
It's the coolest name in jazz. We should do the Bix and Trumbauer blockbuster sometime.
Just saying, Bix Evans. Anyway.
Yeah.
Too late now, dude.
It was available. It was available. You know, on the cover, he looks, on the cover of Starfish and the Moon, he looks more like Bill Odenkirk than anyone, Bob Odenkirk than anyone should.
But I mean, he is, Bill Evans, pianist, was very much the 50s style until, you know, you got the 70s, he grew his beard out and everything, but, you know, horn-rimmed glasses, short black hair, very melancholy, intent look, but Bill Evans, saxophone player, is the whitest man who ever lived. It, just in his look. I mean, he's a very funky guy, but you look at him, he's like, man, wow, you are a Caucasian dude. And he's probably like 15% Indian and very offended right now. But, and just, you know, just a very pleasant looking, but, like the guy next door mowing his lawn in a flannel shirt kind of dude. And maybe he borrowed from me. I got some flannel I can loan you, Bill. He's a very pale dude. Bill Dixon is not. God bless him. So Bill McHenry, also a pale dude, saxophone player, and
yeah, Roses, baby,
Roses,
Sunnyside, 2008.
Right, who's on this little number?
So he's got two players who'd been with him a lot, and they had rotated around drummers. So yeah, he plays tenor, and then Ben Maunder on guitar, and Reed Anderson. Have we talked about Abolish Bad Architecture?
I think you've mentioned it. We haven't done it. And Reed is, of course, from the Bad Plus, right?
Yes.
But this is an album that you've been kind of, I've not heard it, but you've been talking it up. So maybe we should stick that in the rotation.
We should. But anyone on the Bad Plus, their solo projects are all worthwhile. They are greater. Their parts are all interesting. Anyway, Reed Anderson on bass. And then apparently this group had used different drummers. And on the previous album called, I want to say, Graphics. They brought in Paul Motion, and this, I believe, the second outing of Motion.
Okay.
These guys of, so he's a generation older. You know, Motion is statesman at this point with these guys. But it's an inspired little pairing of him playing with these guys. I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that I am not smart enough to like this as much as I should. I read Ethan Iverson's review. Ethan Iverson is one of the, he's one of the members of the Bad Plus.
Or was, yeah, right.
He's out now, right. But He's a pianist for the Bad Plus, and he is one of the smarter and more interesting reviewers around. And I always
great blogger, he's great.
Yeah, I always feel edified when I read his stuff. And he wrote a piece for Downbeat on this group. Like, he's a big admirer of Bill McHenry. And I don't know if he became aware of Anderson through McHenry, or he knew Anderson and became aware of McHenry that way, but whatever.
He mentions the conflict. I mean, because he says, you know, I've played with this guy, I know about him.
Right.
But I'm still going to say this is a great record, despite the fact I work with Reed. So, yeah.
Exactly. And so when I read his review, I want to like this more than I do, because I like Iverson and I think he's smart and I like a lot of the stuff he writes. But when I listen to this, I don't like it as much as he does. And he anticipates the complaint that I'm going to have about this album. He mentions it in his review, and I'm going to cop to it, and I'm going to say that it's a problem for me, which is that the whole thing feels really samey. There is not a whole lot of variety here on these 9 songs. So essentially, you kind of get a fairly oblique tenor playing against the guitar. Stuff is often kind of medium tempo with no obvious melody. And bass and drums are kind of here, kind of spacey, open, skittery. And you just get, you know, tenor statements, you know, a lot of 8th and 16th notes, nothing super busy, over interesting, but not necessarily melodic chording. And I will say that the songs I like the best invariably are the songs here where Maunder's guitar gets all fuzzed out. Those are the ones that appeal to me. Because McHenry's saxophone, he's real fond of the intervallic leap. So he likes to sort of jump around. And it's demanding on the listener. It doesn't immediately yield up pleasure like, ah, here's a chord, here's a melody, it doesn't do that. And so for me, the songs that I dug were the ones where Maunder's guitar gets all distorted and fuzzed out. And suddenly I felt like there's some gristle here, something to dig into. So the songs that happens on, they're the songs I like the best. The City, The Lizard, which has a ton of leaps by
Leap and Lizards, huh? Okay.
Bill McHenry leaps around a lot on that. And that one, the fuzz guitar stuff there gets way out after some pretty stately chording by McHenry over the bass and drums of the open. And then the final cut, Foyo Synthetic. I don't know what Foyo means, but looks like photo, but with a Y instead of a T. So Foyo Synthetic. Some fairly fuzzed out guitar in the outro on that.
It's Those Bill's way of saying you're not smart enough to like his music properly. It's like, what is this? What is this fucking thing, Bill?
So
if you were smarter, you would know.
Here's the same thing. Same thing with the Bill Dixon. If you're not paying attention, this turns into background really fast. If you are paying attention, you really have to concentrate. And like I said, it doesn't have consistent rhythmic drive from song to song, or melodic, like melodies you can hang your hat on, or at least that this listener can hang his hat on. And so, you know, I end up kind of grokking to, connecting to things that grab my attention here, which are often, you know, the guitar parts that I can kind of understand or enjoy. So I don't like this as much as Iverson does. He really likes this, and I kind of like it, and I feel like I should like it better because I like Iverson and I think he's smart, and I just don't have the moment-to-moment pleasure that he seems to take from this. It sounds, to my ears, a lot of the cuts sound really similar, and I have a hard time finding my way into this. And the moments of resultant pleasure don't make me feel like the payoff was worth it.
Yeah.
The effort to enjoy this.
But even Iverson, wouldn't you say, I mean, I think my memory of the review, and I did happen to run across it too, was of admiration.
Hmm.
As much as pleasure.
Yeah.
He really admires this guy. And I can understand why, because this is a distinctive sounding. I don't think McHenry sounds particularly like any other tenor saxophone player I'm aware of, which is not an easy feet, given how many there are. But yeah, that's different from saying fun.
Yeah, it's not fun. At least I didn't have fun. There are moments that I enjoy, but I don't listen to this and go, yeah, I want to hear that again. I was like, okay, I feel like parts of me are edified and parts of me are tired. I didn't get a huge amount of pleasure from this. I got some pleasure from it. And I, like I said, I want to like it more than I do. So yeah, that sounds like I really hate it. I don't. It's just that I don't, it didn't give me huge oodles and scads and mountains of pleasure. It was challenging and oblique, and I don't know. I mean, I like some really oblique, out, challenging stuff, but this didn't work for me as much. I don't know why. I hate to say that, because all the players here are good. What are you going to say? Paul Motion's not God. He's God. It's just,
a bald Armenian. Yes, I always knew that must be the case.
How'd you feel about it?
Yeah, well, when you mentioned doing this album, I got to say my heart sank, because I just remembered not liking it. And then I listened to it, and my memory was absolutely accurate. Yeah, I don't care for this record very much. Everything you've said about it, I'd say at least that much, if not stronger, from me. It maybe at some point there will be this blinding revelation and I will get the why of it. I don't feel any why. I don't feel any sense of what is being expressed. It's like he's playing these patterns that are, you know, I talk about what I think of as the Greg Osby, who's the other saxophone player? Steve Coleman school of, you know, they're playing solos that seem to be almost to the inch, a certain distance from the chords. They're out, but they aren't atonal by any stretch. They're related to the harmony, but they aren't the obvious choices that like a swing player would play or even a post-bop player would play. They're just further out. They're calibrated in a way that you don't get absolute clashes. You also never get quite resolution. They're hovering out there. And it's like Bill has taken this and gone yet a step further out, and just everything is a little bit of a clash, a rub. It none of it quite fits at all. It's like furthest enough out that it's constantly grating, because it is the note choice that does not fit in the chords easily, that is quote-unquote a wrong choice. Now, I'm not saying he doesn't know what he's doing. He absolutely does. There's no question. In some ways, I wish he did not know what he was doing so well. I wish that he was just kind of experimenting or just playing on intuition more or whatever, because this all sounds very considered. And that's got to do with, he's mentioned the median tempos, the fact that he's not somebody that's, I just don't find him expressive when he plays. At least in a way that I find humanly relatable. Again, it may be that the real aficionado is just having a fantastic moment every time he puts the horn to his lips and just gets his language and gets the way he expresses himself and it communicates. But for me, it does not. And so it's a series of notes that all are far enough outside of the implied harmonies to be grating. He's not an energy player. He's not a squealer.
Nope.
It's just that every note is not neither the obvious choice nor the subtle choice. It's the quote-unquote, again, not in the sense of him making a mistake, he's making a choice, the wrong choice, the note that doesn't fit. And the whole solo is built of this, so there's no tension release, there's just tension.
Yeah.
And there doesn't tend to be flurries of notes, or, you know, it's all very methodical, and it's like just nothing but bran for you. It's all fiber, no sweet, no fruit. And yeah, I just, none of these performances touch me at all. Very well done. I listened to his project with John McNeil, that's kind of a tribute to the cool jazz period. McNeil's done a couple of these.
Yeah.
It's more accessible. I don't know that combination thrills me. And this little dirty secret of cool jazz is there was always some kind of romanticism underneath the surface of most of it. If nothing else, you know, that of existentialism, but something, right? Some kind of feeling. Tamped down. Whereas, again, I, and I don't want to like rag on this guy because he's obviously a fine musician. He's got listeners who very much respect him. And, you know, Ethan Iverson's a smart dude. And I get that he's, you know, you can argue in a difference. You know, I've talked about saxophone players who no one is going to argue is bringing anything new to the table technique-wise or harmony-wise or whatever. They just make a good-sounding record. Javon Jackson, that album we talked about.
Yeah.
You know, there's not a fucking thing he's doing on there that was not been done 100 times before. He just does it with a certain amount of conviction and style and warmth that I like that particular record. It comes off because we all speak a language and most of it's inherited, right? You know, most of us who express ourselves in English, we're not coming up with new words, but sometimes the way somebody strings a sentence together doesn't touch you or annoys you, and other times it does. And the language of hard bop or whatever has been used a lot, but if somebody really is gifted in expressing themselves in it, it can still, I think, be effective. This is the opposite of that. I think he is new. I think this is not much like anything I've heard before. I just don't like it. Mm. So, yeah, a long rant there. And again, by all means, listeners, I'm not saying don't listen to this record. In fact, I strongly recommend that you do, because I, you know, find out if you're the guy or the gal who is smart enough to, because if you are, you're going to love this to fucking death. I mean, because there's this particular take on what to do with a jazz quartet. I don't think there's a lot of analogs to, you know, I think it's pretty unusual. But me personally, yeah, every time it came on. And again, it's not. I'm not sitting there thinking, "Oh, these guys can't play. They don't know what they're doing." No, not at all. Quite the opposite. But
they know what they're doing. You just don't like it.
That's right. You know, and it's like, and they're damn. You know, they've got the damn right to do it. And you know, I'm not going to criticize them for doing it. I am impressed, and I do admire it in that sense. You know, it's I'm on board with that. You know, it's like, yeah, I just don't want to hear it. So sorry about that. Nope. Turn that one off. Don't want to hear that again. Yeah. Oh well. Some Bills are more likable than others. Some Bills' mothers are, anyway. If you would have traveled on the 93 North today, oh, you would have seen how the light laid on Main Street. If you would have traveled on the 93 North today, oh, you would have seen how your mind changed on Main Street. And you would have seen the naked feet, and you would have seen how the light laid on Main Street, yeah. Pop Matters, you got anything in your mind?
I'm really mad that I missed Theo Kroeker was in town. And I was too sick to go see him. It was last Friday, and I just couldn't drag myself out, and I really wanted to. I heard he had a pretty good concert, but I just couldn't get there. I wanted to see if he wore a shirt or not. But
Not by the end of the show.
Not by the end of the show. So, yeah, let's see. What have I been listening to lately that's interesting? Mentioned Jarvis Cocker, the lead singer of
Pulp 4. Recently.
Just put back into the rotation recently his self-titled debut from 2006. Known as the Jarvis Cocker record. It has the word Jarvis on the cover with an arrow pointing to his head in case you weren't sure who he is. The only thing that is really important about this album is the closing song, which was used as the closing credits in the wonderful Children of Men film, which on the American release is known as Running the World. But the full title of this song is Cunts Are Still Running the World. And this was from back in 2006 when W was president. And it's a terrific song about how the people running the world are just fucking idiots. And somehow it seems appropriate yet again, 13 years later. So
somehow
there's that. Also in the rotation recently, something that you turned me on to and that you no doubt love to death. I don't love it as much as you do, but we should talk about it briefly. The Negro Problem. Post-Minstrel Syndrome is what's been in the rotation lately. This weird pop rock band fronted by this wonderful singer named Stu. Why do you like them so much? You turned me on to them, and I like them, but I think you like them
well,
more.
I think of the two records I've heard, I like Welcome Black much better than this one. I like this one okay, but Welcome Black for me is a standout.
Yeah. This is the one with the MacArthur Park cover. Yeah. And instead of leaving the cake out in the rain, he says, someone left the crack out in the rain. I don't think that I could take it because it took so long to make it.
Oh, God. Yeah, he's funny.
He's a very funny guy. And I enjoy this. The lyrics are hilarious. And, you know, titles are great. Doubting Uncle Tom, Ghetto Godot, you know, stuff like that. He's a smart guy. And the lyrics are terrific. But, yeah, it's not something I'm going to play before class for my students in case they, you know, Shazam it. They're like, what the fuck? He's listening to the Negro Problem. What is this? You know?
That's right. Yeah, they're gonna cancel you.
I know. I'm gonna get in trouble. So yeah, I'm careful about what I listen to before lectures. You know that I pretty much keep it to, you know, dad rock for the most part.
You don't want to get OK Gen Xer'd. You know.
I don't want to get. Yeah, I don't want. I don't want to get OK. I don't want to get OK Millennial. OK Boomer'd. Yeah, I don't want that. So anyway, you like this? I like it too. But I agree with you. I like Welcome Black better.
That's if you have one album of the Negro Problem, you're already in trouble. But the one to get is Welcome Black. I mean, that's the one where I'm Sebastian Cabot. I mean, that alone means he's one of the immortals. I just, you know, that's great, because everyone needed to write a song about being Sebastian Cabot, but he did it. He was the only one brave enough to do it.
Two other things in notation recently. One is Sean Colvin's first album, which most people don't know, called Fat City, which is fucking awesome. Big fan of that album. It's when Sean Colvin was like a Hello Kitty cover girl material, and they really marketed her as such on the album. I've had this since way back in...
Does that have like Steady on it?
Nope.
Okay, this is even earlier than that. Okay.
That's earlier. It's very much in a Ricky Lee Jones bag, and it's got like... four or five really good songs on it. This is before she became more sort of, this is before the girl, the women, remember the concerts, what did they call those? Fuck, I forget what it's called.
I know what you mean, but I can't think of it right now.
The Indigo Girls and all these people went and did sort of women rock concerts as a kind of festival circuit thing.
Lilith Fair,
she's a part of that, I think.
Thanks, 90s brain cells. Yeah, thanks for coming back online there.
This is from before that, and I just think the songcraft on this album is really good. And like I said, very close to a Ricky Lee Jones bag here before she became more mainstream, poppy, folky. And then in my ongoing quest to just understand the world of rap, I have got, and I do not even know how to describe this album. It's a rapper, a guy named Danny Brown, and... oh my God, this motherfucker. The name of the album is Atrocity Exhibition. And
oh God, so he's a Joy Division fan, huh? Okay.
Yes, he is. And I don't even know how to describe this album. It's like he takes minimalist beats. He's got a high-pitched, almost squeaky voice. And he takes minimalist beats from really fucking weird places. So this guy's got big ears. He listens to weird, out-there stuff. This is like experimental rap. It doesn't feature a lot of guest stars, but like Kendrick Lamar is one of them. So that kind of tells you where we're at a little bit. It's like someone listened to Trent Reznor's Nine Inch Nails, slowed down to like, you know, a quarter speed, and then said, I'm going to sample those three bass beats. And then I'm going to like improvise weird, spacey, drugged out rap over that.
And then I'm going to make your mother cry. Yep.
Well, and the cover is scary. Like you talk about album covers that, you know, are, you know, it's a scary fucking cover. And I find this guy just compulsively listenable, and I have no fucking clue what's going on. I just listen to it and I'm like, I've never heard rap music like this. He's just, it's sparse and strange and experimental and smart and weird as fuck. And I like it. I just, you know, it's not the usual. I had recently listened to some Jay-Z who I'm trying to understand a little bit. And I don't quite, this will be sacrilege to the fans out there, but I don't quite see what all the fuss is. This guy is scary. Like this guy is, he's dangerous. And he's not dangerous because he's like, you know, I took a Glock and I shot your mom. He's dangerous because it's like he's having a weird freaked out drug episode that he's freestyling over while he's having it. That's why he's scary. Like, this guy has looked into the abyss, and he's going to rap over it.
Rapping over the abyss.
I think he is fucking compelling. I can see me really digging this, like, the more I listen to it. Like, on the first listen, when it first started, I was like, what the fuck is this? Like, what is this? And then the more I listened to it, the more I thought, this guy is a genius. He's just a stone-cold fucking genius. He is so far out there. Like, if there's a difference between, like, in and out and jazz, this guy is out rap. That's what he is.
There you go.
So I like it. And he's recorded several albums, so I'm going to dig deeper into his stuff. This is from 2016. I think he has a recent thing that just came out this year, and I got to track it down.
It's his Christmas album. You'll love it.
Yeah, right. His Christmas album. I mean, I'm serious. It's like, you remember the Downward Spiral by, you know, Nine Inch Nails?
Vaguely. I got to admit, I never got too deep into those guys.
Right, you know, but it's like Trent Reznor, basically, you know,
of course, yeah.
I kill myself and, you know, life is meaningless and despair. Well, this is like the rap version of that. That's what's going on.
That's good. I need some more meaningless and despair in my life, so I'll have to
The thing that's great about it is it doesn't have like these propulsive, it's got beats, but they're like slow and ominous. It's not like, you know,
right,
the dance floor. It's like, this is what your brain melting sounds like. I like this a lot.
The slow and the ominous. Yeah, that sounds cool. Yeah, I jack shit. Just absolutely. I guess I decided a little bit drunk at dinner tonight that I like Aladdin Sane a little bit better than I thought I did. Basically is as far as I've gotten there. It's,
well, baby steps, Patrick.
You know, it's. I still think it's a little bit overrated. I think people that say that it's better than Ziggy Stardust are nuts. And I think that I've said before that the one about George Orwell and the rest actually has more good songs on it than people acknowledge. But there you go. Early David Bowie. And that concludes Jazz Bastard Podcast 180. Want to drop us a line? You can do so at pat@jazzbastard.com or mike@jazzbastard.com. You can look me up on Facebook or contact me at All About Jazz. The podcast can be downloaded from www.jazzbastard.com, from Apple Podcasts, from Mixcloud, from Stitcher, and from time to time I post it on All About Jazz. Tune in next time as we're going to record an episode on Mike's birthday and talk about Christmas music by such artists as Stan Kenton, Cherry Allen, Paul Horn, Dave McKenna, and there's a mixer as well, Jingle Bell Jazz on Columbia. So that should put you in the holiday mood. But till next time, take care.